Today we're talking with Dave Gussack, Florida State University Art Department over there. He's got a new book. We're going to talk about that and the whole business of art therapy. Fascinating topic. Jeff Schwerz is with us. He's going to talk about another fascinating topic, this FBI investigation that's been going on for some time. So you stay with me. We got a great show lined up for you.
Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny, brought to you by Widen Glass, Tallahassee's first name in glass for your home or office, and by Merry Maids. Call Merry Maids. Relax. And it's done. Widen Glass takes care of Tallahassee business. Local contractors know Widen Glass has been taking care of business since 1945. They prefer Widen Glass because of their precise window glass replacement, masterful shower enclosures, and storefront glass. Widen Glass will take care of you to your complete satisfaction. That's been Widen's way of doing business for 65 years. When you call Widen Glass, you're dealing with experienced, reliable professionals who offer only the best. Like Widen's top-of-the-line bath enclosures that provide style and luxury at an affordable price. Eye-catching storefronts are a specialty at Widen Glass. We'll help you design it and install it. We've done hundreds of storefronts in the Tallahassee area. That's why Widen is known for taking care of business. Widen Glass, the first name in glass replacement. Call 222-5781.
So here we are, my dear friend. We're back with another exciting edition of your favorite radio show and mine, Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny. Online, you can go anytime to TallahasseeTalks.com. You can subscribe to the podcast if you don't get to listen to me yakking at you on Saturday mornings. We do a repeat play, by the way, Saturday nights, 9:30 on MooseMagnificat.com, our very own radio station, online at MooseMagnificat.com. Wednesdays at 5:30 as well. All for your education, your inspiration, your amusement, perhaps. Curiously enough, we find a lot of people coming back to us and saying, you know, what I like about the show is that it is entirely unpredictable. Well, that really is a compliment. I think you would want your a show of this kind to have a sort of spontaneity or kind of a casual aspect to it, because the premise is that you're getting to listen in on a conversation that happens just as real, honest conversations do, in a kind of exploratory way, and just kind of getting to know people and one another. And that's what we've got today with Jeff Schwerz. He's going to be with me in the he's going to be with me in the first hour here. And then I've got Dave Gussack. He'll be with me in the second hour. Dave's been with us before. Fascinating fella. Highly contributive to this whole business of art therapy. And as a faculty member over there at Florida State University for a number of years, has really advanced that whole profession, not only through his teaching, but through his writing. So he's got one or two now textbooks that are out there, and one forthcoming. So he's prolific in that capacity and contributive all the way around. He's done a remarkable amount of work with those who are incarcerated and the use of art therapy in that setting. It's really fascinating, because at its core, art therapy simply abides with this idea that people can, and any of us, can express ourselves in a visual way, that is to say, in a graphical way, by using art in our own means to get in front of whoever it is that we're communicating with, what we really have going on inside. I suppose a simpler way of saying that is, I may not be able to tell you what I'm feeling or thinking, but I can draw a picture of it, okay? So honestly, that is the business of not just art therapy, but those art therapists who are either trying to help someone improve their lot in life, So therapeutically speaking, there's that contribution to their good using this particular form of therapy, which in and of itself is expanding. I mean, art therapy is kind of the cutting edge when it comes right down to it. Dr. Gusak will talk with us at length about that. So you want to make sure that you stay with me for that in the second hour. We come back to this business of Tallahassee's well-being and our future and where we stand today with such things as this ongoing FBI investigation that has captivated our attention, I think. It certainly has been big news for a small town for a number of months, courtesy of people like Jeff Schwerz, Jeffrey and his partner, the other Jeff, as is often said, the two Jeffs over there at the Tallahassee Democrat, have been about the business of holding people accountable, getting access to public records, getting access to the information as it comes to them as a news organization. And so we're going to find out we'll get a snapshot. We won't get all the details, but we're going to get a good dose of what life has been like for this man for the last, 18 months. Shortly after his return to Tallahassee, all of this sort of opened up, and the business of how CRA money has been handled, managed, became very pertinent. And, of course, all of this beginning with the announcement of these indictments that, hit this town like a ton of bricks. There's been a bit of what would you call it? A kind of dismay beyond the shock. There's been this sort of pushback from some who have said, "Oh, come on now, you know this is a good town, we're good people, and we're just making too much of this." And by the way, it's really cutting into our business community in very unfortunate ways. And so we just need to move on. We need to wrap this thing up. Well, thankfully, I think, we have people like Jeffrey Schwerz who are willing to hang in and say, well, not so fast. Let's dig a little further here. You know, the final outcome has yet to been determined. Will there be any kind of prosecutory activities going forward? I mean, will there be any one individual, or will there be a multiple number of individuals who end up having to answer for what have been alleged as some misdeeds? And again, it's all alleged, and there's nothing here that one could say outright should be the status of the situation. You can't at this point say any more than what the facts will bear, and that in and of itself is why we asked Jeffrey to come in and try to help us all better appreciate what those facts are to date. And so everything that we'll talk about is in that context. It's in that capacity that all of these activities, whether they are good, bad, or indifferent, are alleged, and we're all just going to have to wait to hear how it all turns out. But in the meantime, you get to learn from a guy firsthand, like Jeff Schwerz, what it entails. Well, I tell you, we have some other news for you from around town, and you want to make sure that you pay attention to some of this stuff, because it's going to hit pretty close to home, no pun intended. But the city is helping us prepare for weather threats, and they're going to have sandbag locations that open up through the weekend here. And this has to do with being prepared for this weather system that has developed out there in the Gulf, and not knowing exactly how that's going to play out, but certainly it's going to represent some pretty heavy rainfall and could cause some localized flooding. So to assist citizens with preparing for heavy rainfall, potential flooding, community sandbag locations are now open. They opened yesterday, as a matter of fact. James Messer Park South, down there on Jackson Bluff. Winthrop Park over on Mitchell Avenue. Tequesta Park out on Tequesta Drive and Deer Lake Road in Killarn Lake. So it's another location. The Appalachian Regional Park, where they or we have our solid waste management facility. They're going to have sandbags for you. And then J. Lee Vaz Park is over there on Old Bainbridge Road. That's a county facility. And even at the intersection of Oak Ridge Road and Ranchero Road, you'll be able to pick up sandbags if you need them. If you want to get updates on this, you can do that easily enough. You go to talgov.com. Okay, so go to talgov.com for any updates on these locations. Sandbags are limited to 25 sandbags per household. News that you need to know on this holiday weekend. Happy Memorial Day, everybody. Glad you're with me. You stay tuned. We've got more coming up.
1868, General John Logan calls for a national day of remembrance in honor of those slain on the field of battle during the Civil War. May 30th was chosen as the day when Americans across the nation would gather to offer prayers for the fallen soldiers and their families. 100 years later, Congress declared the last Monday in May to be the nation's official Memorial Day. When we join together in remembering our first responders, law enforcement, and all those in military service who have given their lives in defense of freedom and kept us from harm's way. This Memorial Day tribute is brought to you by Southern Smiles Family Dentistry in Quincy, online at southernsmilesfl.com or call 875-3908. Healthy Solutions, online at hs-med.com or call 309-0356. Sperry & Associates, online at sperryconstruction.com or call 562-1101.
Hi, I'm Melissa Bruner, and you're listening to Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Jeffrey Schwiers is an award-winning veteran reporter who has come full circle in his career, returning to the Tallahassee Democrat 2 years ago as its watchdog reporter. He started his career at the Democrat covering K through 12 issues when he was a thinner and had more hair on his head. Well, I didn't write this now.
I don't know, that's for the benefit of the people who can't
I don't know
see
why,
what this
I don't know why we had to include that. But in any case, more importantly, his career took him all over the country, from Tallahassee to Las Vegas, back to Florida. He's covered the Florida legislature for several news organizations, has the distinction of being the last Capitol Bureau reporter for the Tampa Tribune before that newspaper was shut down. He's an alumni of the Independent Florida Alligator and the University of Florida. Let's welcome our guest this morning, Jeffrey Schwiers. How are you, sir?
I'm doing very well. Thanks a lot.
I think you have plenty of hair, and
I look
fine.
Quite more. That's just a nice way of saying that. It's been a long time since I started my career.
For all of your high school friends that are trying to figure out who is this guy,
who is this guy?
Yeah. Well, we're glad you're here. And, Jeff, you've certainly contributed sizably over the last 2 years that you've been here, even within the last 18 months, especially regarding such things as FBI investigations and, you know, city commissioners and CRA money and all of this that has, you know, we didn't want you to get bored. So apparently upon
well,
your return.
Guarantee you that I have not been bored since coming back to Tallahassee. It's been an amazing ride, the variety of stories that I've done, and then just since a year ago June, when the subpoenas were dropped on City Hall, my partner Jeff Berlow and I we've written between like over 100 stories just on the FBI investigation of the city and the Community Redevelopment Agency, right, or at least trying to figure out what the investigation really is about.
So what I want to see is your Facebook posting prior to your return to Tallahassee. Yeah, I'm going to go back and just kind of, you know, ease in, just take it easy for, you know, this will be a nice way of kind of finishing out my career.
I wish I could say that.
Bam.
Bam. No, well, you know, and then I came back here to cover the legislature for the Tampa Tribune.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was certainly vacation either. I mean,
no,
it was like it was no walk in the park because it was a very tumultuous session. Huh. And and then a month after or 2 months after the session ended, the Tampa Bay Times bought the Tampa Tribune and shut it down.
So you still have your hazmat suit in the closet. Is that what you're telling me?
Yeah. So, and then, you know, luckily, fortunately, the Tallahassee Democrat you know, saw my situation and asked mm. me to come over and start writing for them. And mm. I was very happy to because, you know, I found a really good team to work with over there.
That's my take as well.
You know, having that that bit of, you know, experience under my belt, it's you know, it's mellowed me. It's you learn how to get along with other people, and you learn how to yeah. be a team and not be a bunch of individuals.
And that's especially, I would think, that's especially critical in the kind of business that you find yourselves, where every second that goes past is another deadline. There's another. So the pressure is always on, especially in the 24-hour news cycle we live.
Well, yeah, we're not a print product only anymore. We haven't been for a long time. We are, you know, we are online, and we are constantly breaking news yeah. online. You know, as
there's never
as
any closure.
There is. It's not like there is not ever a deadline. There's always a deadline.
It's like
and yeah.
It's like so as soon as you hit send, you're on to the next assignment, or you've got several at one. How does that
sometimes
work?
Sometimes that's very literally true. Sometimes you finish one story.
Yeah.
You go right to the next yeah. one, and or you know, sometimes, you know, in the course of like say a 24-hour cycle, we might break a story and with just nothing more than a sentence.
Yeah.
And then as we develop material and interview people and we build that story online.
Yeah.
And we
give, as it like, happens.
As it happens with, yeah. you know, noting the hour and the minute that we're updating.
Isn't that incredible?
With fresh information.
It really is.
It's amazing. And it then is very and then we and then at the end of the day we take all that and turn it into a story for the next day and come in the next day and start all over again.
Start
so,
all over.
Yeah, it's exciting.
The CRA story, the FBI investigation for you in your career. Where does that rank in terms of, I don't know, the most engaging, the most demanding, the most OMG? I don't know.
All of the above. It is, yes, it is without a doubt the most important story I think I think of all the work that I do is important. And, you know, you find that out sometimes after, like when I'm leaving a community to go to another place that people say, what are we going to do without you? You've been done such a great job covering the county commission or the school board or whatever. And I think that's, you know, but a story like this is like so many shades and levels above, you know, just being able to inform people. It's being able to provide insight, being able to try to give a sense of where this thing is going
yeah.
without getting too far ahead of ourselves,
yeah.
without speculating, you know, trying to be responsible and level-headed and, you know, and it's challenging because, you know, it's like, imagine you're on a treasure hunt and the only bit of information you have is a scrap of paper that says, we want 90,000 pages of meeting records and minutes and emails about, you know, these half dozen or so people and their business entities and, you know, their involvement with the CRA. And that's all you have to build your map with. It's yeah. like, okay, we have this. This is our,
wow.
we have to take the subpoena and use that to go forward in making our own, you know, separate requests for other public records.
Right.
And try to put together what is happening here, you know, like, and the value of that just to the public is letting them see the process, you know, or letting them see the connections between the people doing business with the CRA and the people who sit on the CRA or, you know, things that you don't normally see you know, when you hear that so-and-so got a grant. A facade grant. Well, that's all you know. Then we get a chance to go kind of to pull the curtain back
yeah.
in this kind of an investigation.
Talking with Jeffrey Schwerz. He is the veteran reporter over there at the Tallahassee Democrat, their watchdog reporter, as they've affectionately referred to. Certainly doing a bit of that for us here today. Thank you for tuning in. You are in tune with Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny. We'll be right back.
So if you come to me and say, I want to buy a home, the first thing I do is say, okay, let's talk about the process. What can I afford? Not just the purchase price. What kind of lifestyle do you want to have?
Tiffany Hamilton, broker of Eck and Hamilton Realty, talking about the real estate market in Tallahassee.
Right now, for an investor, in my opinion, we should be looking at affordable housing. What that means is a price point of about $100,000 to $200,000 price range. For the investor, it's a rental income between $1,000 and $1,500 a month max.
Realtor, broker, consultant Tiffany Hamilton is helping home buyers, investors, and other realtors achieve their individual goals.
Hi, I'm Tiffany Hamilton. Investing in real estate or buying a home has never been more challenging. Even finding solid information you can trust can also be a challenge. That's exactly why I began my career nearly 15 years ago, to help buyers and sellers overcome those challenges. As a broker, as a realtor, or a consultant, if I can help you achieve your goals, it would be my pleasure.
Call 850-366-8433 or online at TiffanyHamilton.com.
More beauty, less bully. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
We're back. We're talking with Jeffrey Schwierz, who has said it's okay to call you Jeff. So
yeah, Jeff's
we're gonna,
fine.
We're going to go with the informal. You have for your 2 years now on your upon your return to Tallahassee. We talked about this in the first few minutes we were talking, being launched into this story.
You know, at the very outset, it was like, you know, the proverbial fire hose. You know, yeah. I hate to use that phrase, but
felt that way.
It felt that way because we were uncovering so much information, and then we would get an occasional break, and then there would be another like flood of information and more stories, and then you know, and I think the readers have seen that kind of ebb and flow where, you know, we would try and set up a game plan. Like, we're going to look into this group over here, and we're going to look into this guy here.
Right.
What are their connections to this person or that person? What are their trying to, you know, suss out who else was involved in these projects where they got CRA money?
You're starting to pull on this thread, and the thread is just going on and on. How much of that came to you? How much of it have you had to dig for and go out and find, or has it been a sort of 50-50?
Well, I think the first part was, you know, building the foundational stories based on the subpoena and the information in the subpoena. It gave us the names of people.
Yeah.
It gave us their LLCs that had been doing business with the CRA. Yeah. And we would go and, all right, well, what were these businesses? What projects did they bring before the CRA, and how much money did they get? And basically, you know, compiling, you know, data. Here's what we know.
Yeah.
This is, you know, this is potentially the scope of the FBI's investigation. You know, and then we started, then at some point, we started getting, you know, tips about different aspects, and we'd follow them through, and sometimes they panned out, sometimes they didn't. And then another subpoena, you know, then we got another subpoena that for the first time named an elected official that, you know, the FBI was interested in. And so that took us off in a whole other set of directions. You know, we had fertile fields already.
So I'm getting this picture. Who's walking into whose office at this point, right? Is it you walking into Hatfield and going, you're not going to believe this?
Or Hatfield would come to me and go, have you seen, look at this email that I found. You know, a lot of the information that came out of the FBI subpoenas and our subsequent public records request for all those records were emails that were, exposed a lot of information that we were able to tell our readers about.
Yeah.
So it was just, talk about an exercise in deep diving into public records and, you know, also, you know, the learning the value of a public records request and how important the state's public records laws are. The public records law in Florida is so important to our job as reporters. You can get so much information that, you know, isn't readily available, but it's there. And
the backstory on that is that the city finally had said to you, nah, we're not doing this unless you're willing to pay this enormous fee.
Well, there was a huge amount of money that they wanted to charge us, and we fought that. And, you know, then there was also an issue with a specific bit of information that we requested that they said didn't exist that we found out did exist. And that led to them rewriting their public records rules about text messages and using their personal cell phones and personal, you know, emails that you, that now the city commission didn't have this rule. And now before they didn't have this rule, and now they do.
Now they do.
So, you know, as far as being a watchdog and providing a public service, and one of the things that every reporter I know has ever, you know, hoped for is a story or a series of stories that leads to some sort of reform or change, or, you know, change in a statute
for the
or
public good.
Change in an ordinance that is for the public benefit.
Yeah, yeah. When you are in the midst of all of it, right, it's got to be this swirl of information. And I don't even want to ask you how many hours you, I mean, do you actually have a life left by the time you're engaged in something of this magnitude? And I mean, for all of you, there's a lot of late night hours being burned in the process, I would have to imagine.
Yeah, there have been, you know, we try to keep it sane. We don't want to burn out. And, you know,
Skip was burned out when he got here. I mean, you know, that was him saying that, not me. You know?
You mean from when he came from Fort Walton to Tallahassee? Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, I mean, I had just, look.
I know he's listening, so I have to, you know, throw something at
him. Well, if he is, hi, Skip.
Yeah.
I mean, I had come from the Gainesville Sun, where I had covered the University of Florida. And I had done my own, already been through, you know, 2.5 years of going back and forth with their flex over public records.
Yeah.
And some of the public records that I was after were like their, you know, the UF campus police department's investigative reports on sexual assault. Hmm. And also I pulled the veterinarian records of their lab animals, especially the beagles. In fact, I won a first place in the Florida Society of News Editors for investigative reporting on this piece that I did about beagles and their mistreatment. And the only way I got that story was by, you know, fighting over getting these public records, basically getting veterinarian reports that are public records and door charts, you know, and then following up. Yeah. I mean, it's painstaking. And in the case of like this sort of thing that we've been working on with the CRA is, you know, you're looking at financial records, grant requests, and financial records, and real estate records, and you're looking at how real estate changed hands back and forth and back and forth. Mm-hmm. And I would go home at 7 or 8 o'clock at night, just numb, and then go to bed and start dreaming about it all over again. So even in my sleep, I was like going through, you know, deeds and mortgage paperwork.
So for you, those were dreams. For some other people involved, those were nightmares.
They were nightmares. I mean, the only break is like to occasionally every few months take a week off and get out of town. And
wow.
Yeah, yeah.
That raises the question in my mind, too, as you're pursuing something of this. And it's not, again, like you say, not the first time in your career that is this intense and that there is this much at stake for a lot of stakeholders, including us, the public, right?
Absolutely.
When you are doing your job, does it happen that you are challenged by people, let's say, even offline, who come back to you and, hey, you know, why don't you shape up or this kind of stuff? Or is that just a bunch of drama that I'm, you know,
it's absolutely fair to ask, you know, the question. The kind of feedback I get varies. It covers all sides of the spectrum,
as we like, might expect then. Okay.
You know, a piece, I wrote a piece about, this is unrelated to the FBI investigation, but I wrote a piece about Mayor Gillum's use of a parking pass, an airport parking pass. Mm. And here's the thing, is that the airport has had this policy of giving, you know, a lot of different officials these parking passes so they can park at the airport for free.
Yep.
And, you know, Gillum and the other city commissioners, they all use it. And when we did our public records request and got the information, we saw that, you know, the mayor was using it four times as frequently as the next commissioner. And so we asked, and we found that he was using that, you know, 90%+ of the time for his gubernatorial campaigning, because, as I'm sure all your listeners know, he's running for governor.
Right.
And so that, you know, it raised a question. So for some people, and some people were friends of mine, saying, what is this all about? Oh, that's just, don't you have anything better to write about? And then other people who, you know, would, you would say were good government watchdog types, said, good on you. You know, it's an important story. That's just a good example. And we, throughout the course of what we've been doing with the FBI investigation, you know, we get criticism and praise.
Yeah.
And I don't know if equal measures, but I'd say we're getting more encouragement. I think people want to get to the bottom of this. I think we get, a lot of people want it to end.
Yeah.
You know, we have some city commissioners who are just like, this, you know, this must end, so, because, you know, Tallahassee's great.
Right. Let's just wrap this up.
Let's just wrap this up and move on.
Yeah.
As if there's, you know, no dysfunction at City Hall.
Sure.
There's nothing wrong.
Fine.
And that this, and there's like, this hasn't been, you know, the, then from what the, what we are getting from the FBI investigation, it seems like this is something that's been going on for years.
Remarkable.
You know.
Talking with Jeff Schwerz here about Tallahassee's most recent happenings regarding the CRA investigation, the FBI conducting now what's gone on for better than a year and a half, I guess, maybe in terms of its public awareness. It's been going on for some time beyond that, but it all came to bear when the Tallahassee Democrat began making this available to us in their reporting, and Jeff's been at the heart of that. We should say, and his partner, Jeff. Jeff and Jeff. The two Jeffs. We're going to continue this conversation. You stay with me. We've got more.
Now we're really talking. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
We're back. We're talking with Jeffrey Schwerz. Jeff has graciously endured all of my silliness here. And what comes to me from a lot of folks is, beyond this question of gentrification, which in and of itself is a big deal, but there's also this identity question, and you're pointing to that. And then there's the concentration of all of that within a very small portion of the geography, when people outside of downtown, let's say, or even outside of some of these circles of people, they're not plugged in. The Cascades Park thing, okay, fine, whatever. You know, they just don't get it. So when you look at how things have changed, and we're talking about that, I remember the question came up when they were at Boulder, this contingent from Tallahassee, and that's when this whole segregated city thing hit the fan from, you know, Richard, Florida. Well, all of that was sort of put down and said, that's not the real Tallahassee he's talking about. Well, that flies in the face of people who are saying, yeah, well, there's a whole part of this town that is so separated and so disenfranchised,
and
they don't know how to get involved.
Yeah, they're disconnected from the process. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's a constant, too. I mean, it's, you know, 20 years ago and today, there's this sense that, you know, some people have access and other people don't. You know, when you have an FBI search warrant that lays out a sort of a pay-to-play scheme involving a city commissioner, an alleged pay-to-play scheme that involves a city commissioner and a consulting firm, you know, it affirms what people think is reality, and it's a perception that may or may not be true. We don't know, because we have not gotten to the end of this FBI investigation, but it does. It starts those conversations again, and you have people standing up before the CRA going, you need to just abolish the CRA because it's corrupt and it isn't serving everybody. You're giving millions of dollars to developers who already have money. And this is a quote, paraphrase of what Dr. Edward Holifield said today at the CRA meeting, that, you know, you're giving money to rich people when the CRA's job is supposed to revitalize blighted neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And City Commissioner Curtis Richardson said, you know, he is glad that he finally got the CRA to expand its boundaries to include some really neglected neighborhoods on the south side.
Yep.
And his words to me was then that is going to give us the opportunity to refocus the mission of the CRA.
Yeah.
So, all right, roundabout way of saying that, yeah, you know, there are people who feel like they're not included. There are, you know, maybe that's changing. You know, we've got we're going to have three new city commissioners after the elections in November. We're going to have a new city manager. We already have a new city attorney who's been with the city for a while. You know, something one of the CRA board members said today, they received a business pitch from a developer who happens to be an African-American, and this CRA board member, he's a member of the county commission, said, "This is the first time I've seen, you know, a black company pitch us." You know, so those are reality. Mm-hmm. Those are things that I'm hearing when I go to CRA and city commission meetings. These are things that people are talking about. Then you have statistics that say we have a huge income gap in Tallahassee. We have a very high poverty rate. That certainly is a part of Tallahassee. Yes, Tallahassee is this really generous, giving community full of people who care. I mean, they care about giving to the needy and keeping the food bank shelves stocked and all those things.
Right.
I mean, you know, but we have these statistic realities too. And I wonder if that's what you mean. Like, are these the things that people are saying, oh, that's not Tallahassee?
Right.
When in fact, you know, there is a disenfranchised portion of our population.
Yeah.
I don't know the solution.
Well, I'm asking,
get new people running for office.
Yeah, and I asked that question.
Change the paradigm, perhaps.
I asked the question in relation to the systems that, while the players may change, really determine how questions get asked and answered. So, in other words, we get a whole new bevy of commissioners. But if you haven't changed how things are structured, if you haven't changed how the system works to get things done, well, then you're kind of pushing these people back into that same process. So that has to be part of the consideration.
I guess.
You know, that's my opinion now. I'm not...
You know, the proof is... You know, I guess the challenge then is for the public to ask these candidates for specific ideas.
Right.
And ask them to, you know, for specific answers to... You know, these problems,
and you know,
before they get elected,
I was at the I was at the NEPA meeting earlier this week or last week, and when in fact the candidates for seat 5 were asked those kinds of questions, not a whole lot of answers, not a whole lot of specifics. Now, maybe it's a little early yet, right? Okay, so nobody really wants to throw down, but come on, man. You got to have some opinions here, and that was just not coming forward. So I don't know if we got to drill a little further on some of this stuff and try to take authority over the questioning.
Sure.
You know?
Well, I mean, and that's the role of an independent, you know, news media.
Yeah.
If we're doing our jobs, and I think we are, then we. It's up to us to challenge the candidates to be more specific than saying something like the devil's in the details or I need more time to examine the issue. When, you know, and in fairness, these candidates, some people who are running for the first time, you know, they have advisors who are telling them not to be too specific, to be vague, because you don't want to get cornered. You don't want to get painted into a corner.
Yeah.
That if you do get elected and then people say, well, remember on the campaign trail you said that you were going to do X, Y, and Z.
Right.
And, you know, and those people, trust me, they will hold those people accountable. And I think it really comes full circle to accountability.
Mm.
You know, we have a job to hold public officials accountable. I think you and your listeners, our readers, have a job to tell us what we should be asking the elected officials, the candidates that are running for office. You know, is us really, we serve our readers, we serve the public. You know, if we're able to ask the public's questions and give them the answers, then I think we're doing okay.
He is the Tallahassee Democrats watchdog reporter. He is a good friend of this show and to many, and has done a great job for us here this morning. Jeff Schwerz, our guest, and someone who I think we're going to have to stay a lot closer to, if time permits. Now, recall that he's spending 18 out of every 24 hours doing his job over there, so we may not get to see him again for a while. But thank you, Jeff, for making time for us this week.
It was my pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and likewise.
Hope to come back again.
Likewise.
All right.
We'll keep reading. We'll keep finding out from your standpoint what the facts are as they come to bear on this question of not just the CRA investigation, but all the things that you've been good about keeping us informed of.
Thanks.
We appreciate you. Folks, that's what I've got for you here at the moment. You stay with me. I've got more Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny after this.
My dog was in bad shape, and I was scared. I had never seen her so sick, and my mind was racing. What to do? Who to call? I mean, I raised her from a puppy. She's like my best friend. A few years ago, she developed diabetes, and I've been following her daily regimen carefully. But that morning, something just wasn't right. She could barely move, and I thought, I'm losing my dog. I called a friend, and he said, call Dr. Pliskin. So I called Mahan Animal Clinic. They put me through immediately, and Dr. Pliskin said to get her there right away. Turns out her blood sugar had dropped dramatically, but he knew exactly what to do. I guess you know. There's no other place I would go knowing that Mahan Animal Clinic and Dr. Pliskin are there for me and Aerith.
Special people and special care for those you love. Mahan Animal Clinic on Mahan Drive near Costco. On the web at mahananimalclinic.com or call 402-0557.
The most talked about topics in town. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
We're back, and you are in tune with Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny on this Memorial Day weekend when severe weather is about us. If you caught word of this, the county does have sandbag locations available for you. And I can give you, let's see, I can give you the most recently updated list, but you want to do this for yourself too if you can. Go online to talgov.com. James Messer Park South on Jackson Bluff is one of them. Winthrop Park. We're on Mitchell Avenue. Tequesta Park. And that's at Tequesta Drive and Deer Lake Road out there in Killarn Lakes. Appalachian Regional Park, the Solid Waste Management Facility. You can go there. J. Lee Vaughs Park, which is out on Old Bainbridge Road. That's a county facility. At the intersection of Oak Ridge Road and Ranchero Road. Again, a county location for you. Sandbags. Yeah, you might need them. Expected to get quite a bit of rain because of this tropical system that has formed out there in the Gulf. Can cause power outages. Electric utility crews are on standby, ready to be deployed if needed, with extra staffing. We're all encouraged to stay connected with the city by updating your utility account contact information. And that's at talgov.com/update. Now, you should also do this if you haven't. This nifty little app, it's free, Digitally. And you go and download that from talgov.com. And once that's on your phone, you can tap into the information that comes by way of Digitally, even including which areas of the city may or may not be without power. And if you are in one of those locations, yeah, you're going to want to have that handy. So that's a good thing. You know, it speaks to this whole business of staying prepared. And while I climb up here on my soapbox about such things, and let me tell you that the Tallahassee Prepared campaign is one that we launched several years ago with the idea of it reminding us all to stay prepared, right? County and city officials do a great job, have done a great job, and even a better job in the wake of some of the more horrific hurricanes that we've endured. So the real question is, how well are you and I prepared for severe weather throughout the year? And it requires some forethought, some planning. An evacuation plan is part of that, but it's, again, not the whole story. It can be something as simple as having alternate forms of energy. Maybe you can't afford the generator. You'd like to, but you just can't. Well, what else can you do? You know, if you've got extra supplies of batteries and, you know, safe sorts of luminaries. I mean, we're talking candles and lanterns and such. Emphasis on the safe use of such things. Anytime you're talking about a possible fire hazard, you know, Jerome Gaines over there starts looking at me. Brian, what are you telling these people? Yeah, don't become part of those statistics, please. Fire department doesn't need to be calling it, coming to your house because you forgot and left a candle burning and it fell over and lit something on fire or whatever. So be careful, be thoughtful, and be prepared. That's the whole message. So TallahasseePrepared.com is a good location for you. It's the site that we created years ago that is interactive, and it brings you places on the web where you can find from city, county officials, and other organizations like the American Red Cross, the information that you might otherwise have to go searching for. So the idea is just to make it easier on you and I to have all of that in one location across these various organizations. So we'll be doing that through the coming months. Tallahassee Prepared will become even more active. We will have a public forum again later in the year where we invite public officials to come and share with us their information and updates on that preparedness. You'll have an opportunity to participate in that because you'll be able to show up. We haven't yet determined where we'll be, but we'll be out somewhere in the community where you can visit us, come and be part of the studio audience, and learn firsthand from these fine folks, people like Kevin Peters. I mentioned Chief Jerome Gaines, Rob McGarrow with the city, all of these people that have given hours and hours of their time above and beyond their own required time to help you and I stay prepared. It's a noble effort. Sharon Tyler with it, the American Red Cross, another great individual who, I mean, she just gives heart and soul to this whole process. So we're fortunate that we have such able and committed individuals in our community. Another project that is ongoing here through this weekend and on into the month of June is our Tallahassee Food Challenge. Don't forget that even though we are now heading into the summer and, you know, vacations and outdoor activities and all that that it brings are fun things, there are lots of kids and lots of families that are facing food insecurity. It simply means they don't know when or if their next meal is coming anytime soon. The food charities that supply that need, that help supplement that, are themselves looking to you and I for help because the demand is higher. School is out. School lunches aren't available. Even those food items that are normally sent home with a kid on a Friday afternoon going into the weekend, they're not available. So the demand on local food charities is higher, and our tendency to become complacent, we'll say, or just forgetful about the need increases. So let's see. Increased demand, lower supply. Right. So now you've got food charities that are in crisis themselves looking for our help. Very simply, make your donation today. If you go to Second Harvest website, fightinghunger.org, you can make a donation online right there using a credit card. Or if you want to mail them a check, you can do that. Food drives are fantastic, and the food drives in this town are plentiful. There are a number of great efforts on that level, and we should do that. But when you give a cash donation, you're giving Second Harvest the ability to multiply the effect of that donation by a factor of four. Okay, so a dollar given results in $4 worth of food purchased. So that 4-to-1 ratio, it's remarkable. Well, it's because they have these relationships with national food suppliers. You call it buying power. So $10 buys $40 worth of food. That can feed a lot of people. If you gave $100, yeah, again, do the math. $400 worth of food for a family that otherwise is not going to have what they need to take care of themselves and their kids. So that's what we're all about. Tallahassee Food Challenge and the upcoming Tallahassee Prepared program. All of that for your good and for mine as we try to do better, taking care of one another. We're going to talk to David Gusak here. Dr. Gusak will be with us in this second hour. In terms of taking care of one another, I think you're going to enjoy learning more about this whole business of art therapy and what it brings to not just those who are in need of therapeutic treatment, but what we are learning about ourselves even through this business of art therapy and the world of therapeutic intervention that art therapy brings. You stay with me. I've got David Gusak standing by here, and we'll continue in just a moment. You're in tune with Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
1868, General John Logan calls for a national day of remembrance in honor of those slain on the field of battle during the Civil War. May 30th was chosen as the day when Americans across the nation would gather to offer prayers for the fallen soldiers and their families. 100 years later, Congress declared the last Monday in May to be the nation's official Memorial Day. When we join together in remembering our first responders, law enforcement, and all those in military service who have given their lives in defense of freedom and kept us from harm's way. This Memorial Day tribute is brought to you by Truck and Car Concepts on Mahan Drive at truckandcarconcepts.com or call 656-8800 and Witten Glass on South Monroe at wittenglass.com or call 222-5781. Sellers on Capitol Circle Northeast at sellerstile.com or call 656-8453.
Good morning, friends. This is your friend, Dr. Benjamin Franklin. We're talking with Brian Cerny on Tallahassee Talks.
Dr. Gusak is professor and chairperson for the Florida State University's Department of Art Education. Prior to his teaching for the Florida State University, Gusak was the director of the Graduate Art Therapy Program in the Department of Psychology and Special Education at Emporia State University in Kansas. He has also been an adjunct and visiting professor for many art therapy programs across the United States. He's a big fan of the show and returning as one of our premier guests.
Premier.
Dr. Gusak, how are you, sir?
I wish I could say I was great. I'm a little under the weather.
I hear that.
But you know what? This raspiness works for me. So as long I think the best time is to get me just when I'm on death's door. And
The first time that we had you on the show, I said, you know, you had the perfect name for like a private eye, you know, Dave Gusak.
Yeah.
And so the voice is really helping us.
Yes.
We've got that whole thing. Yeah, Dave Gusak.
Dave Gusak.
He's back. Eye. Dave Gusak.
Not necessarily private eye, semi-private.
Let me not retrash you on those things.
No,
let's get forward on some of the things you've done of late. And for those who may be uninitiated in this business of art therapy and the work that that represents, not just with a given, let's say, population, if we're talking about kids or people who may be incarcerated or whatever, art therapy is informing a lot of other therapeutic approaches, we'll say, or therapeutic ideas, or helping to expand our concept of how therapy really works. Is that fair?
I think that's a great lead-in, because while art therapy certainly works alone and stands alone as its own form of therapy, it also works as an adjunct with other types of therapies. We work closely with other mental health professionals. As our field has developed, although we initially began from a psychodynamic, analytic perspective, over the years we've certainly embraced a lot of other theoretical perspectives.
Okay.
Contemporarily, we're working a lot with through mindfulness and transpersonal approaches and self-psychology. My own personal perspectives is more of a sociological perspective, one of social interaction and relabeling theory, creating new identities through the art-making process.
Wow. And in that capacity, for those who are taking notes here, the reality is that those therapies will say, and those schools of thought, much like any other intellectual marketplace, compete for attention, and they compete in some respects for affirmation and respect. And you know, this is I'm kind of backing away from the rosier side of what you just said and saying, you know, when it comes right down to it, you sometimes, I think, in the business of trying to help people, we can get in each other's way.
Oh, certainly.
If we're trying to protect our own turf or our intellectual investment, and you know, and you mentioned art therapy starting with this sort of psychoanalytic framework, we'll say, or orientation. You know, humbly speaking, the faint amount of experience I had in the world of therapy and therapeutic framework, there was a lot of competition for that. There was a lot
still is
pushback. And
you know, it's funny that you would say that. A lot of my work over the past 27 years has been trying to help the field or work with the field within the field to help create an identity ourselves. Yeah. So while I'm working on the identity of my clients, we're also trying to create a place for where art therapy fits. And what we've discovered over the years, of course, is that, as you pointed out, there's a great deal of territoriality within these fields. And I think most recently what I've been real gratified to see is that art therapy is starting to work much closer with a lot of the other professions. And I think it's because they're also recognizing the research that we put out, the practices that we have, the interactions that we have with them, that they see that there's a value of what we can offer working alongside other fields. So even at, say, at Florida State University, while the graduate art therapy program has been expanding over the past 20 some odd years, we've also been working very closely with the College of Social Work, with marriage and family therapy programs, the counseling departments and programs, music therapy, and personally with criminology and and so there's certainly been relationships that have been created where we all see that perhaps we don't necessarily need to work from a territorial perspective, but rather recognize that what we're all trying to do is get to the same place.
You know? And for those who may not be quite familiar with the let's say the premise here.
Sure.
Art therapy, if I can say this, then you're going to tell me if I'm... Well, let's not do it that way. You tell us what art therapy is.
And then you'll tell me if I'm wrong.
And then I'll tell if you're right or wrong.
Okay, that's good.
Let's do it that way.
All right. Art therapy basically is using... Specifically from a visual arts perspective, there's the expressive arts therapies that involve dance therapy and music therapy and drama therapy. My own perspective is visual art therapy, in which we use the materials and the media to bring about a trajectory of care and treatment and focus for our clients. So while we rely on both the process of the art making as well as the end product of the art piece as a means of soliciting conversation and to help assess a client and where they may be.
Okay.
So much of my work, believe it or not, is nonverbal. And I recognize and work within the capacities and the materials that I use to bring about a trajectory of change within my clients.
And for those who have either been the recipient of a counseling services or have participated in some kind of group therapy, or if you've been on the providership side, you might be the person who has been the counselor at your local community center or maybe working in a school setting, whatever, we all are constantly frustrated, I think, with how it is that we bring to that individual trying to help some means of allowing us in, some means by which...
To work behind the mask.
We can get there. Mm-hmm. and in a way that is, it is in its, of itself, not so intrusive that the person then begins to push to back. Pull back.
That's such a key piece for what my own work is.
Yeah.
You indicated art therapy with incarceration. For those who are familiar with my work in any capacity, I work a great deal with aggressive and violent populations, particularly with correctional populations. Mm. And one of the issues, of course, within the prison is that in order to survive, any disclosure of vulnerability and weakness may be taken advantage of inside. So verbal counseling may leave somebody as a target or as a focus of other people who may wish to take advantage of that. Whereas art and art therapy allow us to work behind the mask that's put in place for survival and allow therapy to happen and care and trajectory of treatment to occur without necessarily having to put it into words. So there's the nonverbal benefit of certain tasks and directives that help bring about change in our populations, that create a container for their aggression and violence, that creates a means of expressing these emotional expressions that are otherwise not available, and finding ways to express themselves when words are just not there.
It's an exciting field, the whole business of art therapy, both in its practice and in all of the academics behind it. We have with us Dave Gusak. He is the art therapy guy for us, and we're learning a lot about it. We'll continue to learn more about him. You stay with me. You're in tune with Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Bringing you whatever Tallahassee is talking about this week. Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
We're back. We're talking with Dr. Dave Gusak. One of my questions for you, Doctor, has to do with expected outcomes, I guess. Mm-hmm. So here you are, or people like you, mm-hmm. working within this realm, art therapy, and you're talking with kids who generally are not really good at telling you what they feel or what they think, especially if they've been traumatized. Mm-hmm. So what are those expected outcomes? Where do you see art therapy taking that individual over time?
That's a great question. And I want to preface this by indicating that my expertise is not with children. Certainly my colleagues here in town, Dr. Marsha Rizal, Dr. Janice Spitzer, Ms. Janice Spitzer, even Dr. Teresa Van Lith and Dr. Parker Bell, who are professors at the Florida State program, they spend a lot more time working with children and developmental processes. I do a lot of work with juvenile justice populations. Mm-hmm. So it really depends on what the needs of the clients are and what they may feel a need to work on, or what the families feel a need to work on, and where our own theoretical perspectives are. For example, my own perspectives might very well be to allow the art-making process and the art therapy to help focus on developing a sense of identity when identities and sense of self-worth and value are broken down because of various environmental or sociological or familial factors or interactions.
So at that point, is there some indication, art therapy is the way to go here?
Oh, absolutely.
How do we know that?
Well, especially with children who may not have the ability to put things into words or not know exactly the best way to express themselves.
That's when it's best called for. Yeah.
Absolutely. Especially with populations like children who are naturally drawn towards art making, especially before we as an educational system start to knock that out of them, because we start to teach them what's the difference between good art and bad art.
Yep.
We want to get to them before that.
Yep.
And so we allow them an opportunity to express themselves in a manner that they're already familiar with, and they may not even realize that therapy is happening.
Right.
But rather, what we're doing is manipulating the process and manipulating the materials and to bring about a desired change or trajectory. Mm-hmm. And of course, that also comes from the model of pathology, that mm-hmm. there is a pathology for us to address. And we're also, as a field, moving away from that as well. What we're trying to do is champion the inner strengths that we have, really focus on the person inside, looking at mindfulness, person-centered, and perhaps one of the major benefits of the art is to help enhance what's already inside and really try and underscore their sense of being, sense of self, sense of calmness, sense of place, when everything else is falling apart around them, where there's a loss of control. The art making itself, depending on how we introduce it, can help facilitate control and stability.
And the artwork itself is instructive, isn't it?
It can be.
For the therapist. I mean, it's almost a kind of window then into that whole situation. not just for kids, for adults too,
for everyone.
And you're looking at, and so what are some of those characteristics when I'm looking at art from, you know, from a art therapy perspective?
Yeah.
What are the triggers, I guess?
That's a really great question, especially when we're talking about some people in the field that try and shy away from the notion of art as assessment.
Yeah.
And that they think that, well, the art shouldn't be used as a diagnostic tool. I'm sorry, if you're an art therapist, you're constantly assessing. Mm-hmm. How else are you going to know the process, mm-hmm. or the progress of your clients? And whereas back in the traditional sense of assessing artwork, we used to look at the symbolic meaning of art, mm-hmm. that's not nearly as prevalent as how the drawing was done. Because specifically, the symbolic content of a drawing is very personal.
Yeah.
And unless you ask the client mm-hmm. what that piece means, mm-hmm. then all we're doing is surmising based on hopefully
our own subjective.
Right. It's filtered through us.
Right.
Right. It's projection on our part.
You're using a lot of black crayon there, Johnny.
Yeah. What does that mean?
Yeah.
It may mean that all I have is a black crayon. Right. Or it's the closest crayon to me. Maybe I'm just particularly lazy.
Right.
But if we look at the formal elements of the art, if we look about the how much of the space of the page is used, what is the line quality? What is the relationship between the objects on the page? How much color is used? Are the colors used in a manner that's consistent with what they're drawing in the image? Mm. All of those formal elements, if combined, can create certain patterns that can reveal for us certain distinguishing characteristics.
And you start looking at that from that individual over time.
Right. Now, whereas a single drawing can provide a snapshot of that person, there was the book that I had done back in 2013,
right,
called Art on Trial, Art Therapy.
I love that
in
book.
Capital Murder Case. Thank you.
I read it twice.
That was you.
Yeah, I didn't Thank understand you. It the first time.
Well, so right. I understood it the first time, didn't understand it the second time. But
did I write this? Yeah,
but
okay.
Who wrote this? But the strength of that book was, my job was to provide expert witness testimony on a collection of art pieces done by a person on trial for murder, and I was given a CD with well over 100 images, and it was went over 20 years worth of work. So I applied the understanding of the formal elements of the art onto all of these pieces, and whereas you can look at a single drawing to determine whether or not the formal elements are giving you some information, what's even more
instructive
yeah. is when you look at a series of drawings. It's so whereas one drawing may be a snapshot, you look at 100 pieces, you're looking at a moving picture, mm. right? You're looking at a flip book, mm. and you're looking at patterns that emerge over those 20 years, and you start to realize that the way the images are placed on the page, the colors that are used, the fragmentation, the rotation, the perseveration that's occurring will reveal, and it did reveal, a schizoaffective tendency that was prevalent during the time of the murder. Mm. And so it was those formal elements, not the quality, or not the, let me rephrase that, not the content, mm. because the symbolic
As
content
such.
Was mm-hmm. quite rich, mm-hmm. and some of it was quite bizarre, and his explanation of it was very unusual, but not very instructive nor useful, mm-hmm. and if I had brought that into court, the prosecuting attorney would have said, wait, this is what you think it is, how do you know that's what it is? But there's no way to refute the scientific basis of the formal elements and the patterns that is revealed based on years of research.
When you think about, and we started the conversation talking about the integration of, or the cooperation of, or the, even if we want to talk about self-respect, you know,
sure.
the discipline kind of growing up among some of
yeah.
these elder representatives of the, we'll call it the world of therapy and such, both in practice and in academia. Where do you think you are in that?
In the developmental process?
Are we still in adolescence here? Is the field grown to the point where
we're young adults?
Yeah.
And it's funny, if I can go back to that case of Art on Trial, one of the benefits of that case was the other expert witnesses, one was a psychologist, one was a psychiatrist, who evaluated and assessed the defendant shortly after the murders, and they came to the conclusion that he had a schizoaffective disorder. But that was after the murder. But by looking at these 20 years of artwork, without even speaking with them. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no collaboration. It was just corroboration.
It was forensic in that way.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And I was able to point out that he does indeed have a schizoaffective disorder, and that's supported with the psychologist and psychiatrist had indicated in court. Yeah. So what we're finding is art therapy is coming into its own. You know, back 20 years ago when I was on the board of directors for the American Art Therapy Association, we had established as a goal that art therapy would become a household term. Well, just this year alone, the identity of art therapy as a field has skyrocketed since we've been championed by the Second Lady of the United States, since we've been on Stephen Colbert's show 2 months ago. Granted, they're not the most idealistic venues for us. There's certainly better ways for to happen. But if we as a field and we as art therapists channel this correctly and hold on to this, we can start taking our place in the pantheon of other creative arts therapies. Mm-hmm. And we're being supported by the other therapies. And so whereas I would have said that we were in adolescence up until this year, I'm starting to think that we're young adults who could still regress. You know?
Okay. Well, let's hope for continued progress in that fashion. We have with us Dave Gussak, who has authored, along with Marcia Rosal.
Yes, that's correct.
This anthology, essentially, The Wiley Handbook of Art Therapy. This is your latest, and then you have another one that's coming after this.
I have one that's coming out in December.
All right. Well, he is an educator, he is an author, he is a researcher, and he is our friend, Dr. Dave Gussak. You stay with me. We got more right after this.
I want to take just a minute and tell you about Chelsea Salon. They are the official hair care salon and spa for Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny. And yes, this is how I am able to bring to you my very best every week. Because, though you can't see me, I know whether I'm at my best, and I need all the help that I can get. So when I go over to see Mary Fannin and her crew, they are proficient in everything they do. Wow. Well, I don't think there's anything that has to do with my personal look and feel that they don't do. Here's one review I read recently. This is a guy here in Tallahassee. He says, I am so happy I found this place, having just moved from Orlando, where I had a wonderful stylist for 15 years. Chelsea is the bomb. Well, there you go, guys. So it's not just for the ladies. Check it out this week. Chelsea Salon and Spa, the official hair care and salon stylists for Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
Hi, I'm Jerry.
And I'm Pete.
And we're with the Jerry Thigpen Trio. And you're listening to Tallahassee Talks with Brian Cerny.
That's the whole point here, is that we're not just analyzing and studying. We really want to contribute to the welfare of others.
We're practicing. Yeah. You know what I really appreciated? And I'm going to do a little bit of... It's going to sound like a commercial, but it isn't.
Well, go ahead.
Well, you mentioned the Wiley Handbook of Art Therapy. That was a 4.5-year project that we were asked
to
put together.
It's a big book.
It's 84 chapters with 90 art therapists.
My goodness.
All in color. Hundreds of... A little over 100 color illustrations.
Wow.
And the reason it's so big is it allows me to, when we were making it, I needed to find something that I could use to sit on so I could see over the steering wheel when I drive home. But the importance of this book, is how it's divided up among theoretical orientations, but research and populations and developmental issues and art therapy around the world and special environments, who do we work with? And the reason that's so valuable is that along with the breadth of the field, this gets into the depth of the field. And this all in one place talks about how art therapy integrates itself along this pantheon of therapeutic care. So it not only talks about the types of historical theoretical perspectives that we have, but from a contemporary perspective, who do we walk alongside? Who do we help? Who do we work with? And how do we contribute to the needs of our clients?
Okay, picking up on that, I want you to tell us about Rhonda. So here we have this drawing that I'm looking at is a young woman who is sitting on a bridge across a river. And in the context of this beautiful anthology, this work that Dr. Gussak has contributed to, we're learning something here about this woman by virtue of this drawing of her. And she doesn't look necessarily distressed or anything else. I mean, that looks like a pretty I don't know, happy,
pretty relaxed image, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing.
First, I want to preface this. This is in the chapter in Art Therapy and Substance Abuse, written by my colleague out in Kansas, mm-hmm. Libby Schmunke, who, by the way, has just recently done one of the first books about art therapy with substance abuse, and it's wonderful. She just came out with it last year. We were pleased that we got this chapter before that book came out. And I think what's key about this drawing, it's she was asked to do what is a traditional therapeutic assessment procedure or theoretical interaction in which you ask somebody to do what's called a bridge drawing. You ask them to draw a bridge and place themselves on the bridge where they see themselves at this current time, thinking that either end is where they're coming from, where they're going. Uh-huh. Matter of fact, Stephen Colbert did a version of that on his talk show. Uh-huh. Again, it's a fairly innocuous directive, and it's uh-huh. sometimes it's got some value, sometimes it doesn't. Uh-huh. And it was developed by Ron Hayes, the late Ron Hayes, a dear friend of ours who passed away this last year up in Philadelphia. The drawing is, it's interesting that you focused on this drawing because it looks like a fairly tranquil image of a woman sitting on the edge of a bridge.
Right.
But if we apply the formal elements of the drawing itself, what we see is that the drawing is done with a single color. It's drawn with very little environment and very little background.
It looks barren, really.
Exactly. That's a great way to describe it. It's barren. The look on her face, again, without getting into the symbolic quality, if you look at the developmental quality of the image itself, of the figure, we see that the details are fairly vague. The eyes are incomplete. We see that she herself seems to be, while sitting on the edge of the bridge, has no real destination,
no
has
direction.
No real movement.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's a great way to assess where she is at this point, which is she really doesn't know where she is.
Now,
she's directionless.
If I'm the therapist in that setting and you're Rhonda,
yeah.
Am I asking you to tell me what that means?
Could be.
Could be. Or am I telling you what that looks like to me?
No. I mean, and there's a lot of things in between there. Certainly, you want to... In some cases, for example, if I was in prison, I may not necessarily engage in a dialogue with my clients about this. Yeah. But I would assume that Libby, as strong as she is, she's so much better at this than I am, I would sense that she would sit down with Rhonda and engage in a conversation on what this image could mean for Rhonda, what this represents. Yeah. But what I wouldn't do, and what the therapist wouldn't do, and what Libby would not do, and I'm happy to say she was one of my students a long time ago, so I know she wouldn't do this. She wouldn't tell Rhonda what this image
interpreted for her.
No, would not do that. That first of all, that does nothing for Rhonda. That creates a hierarchical structure that's no longer interactive.
I'm in charge.
I'm in charge, so I'm going to tell you what's wrong.
Yeah.
No, we're way past that.
Yeah.
But it may be some prodding questions that may come out of that.
I remember you helping me differentiate that from the old Rorschach idea,
right,
where here's the image, doc, and the doc says, oh, well, obviously you have a problem with this.
Right.
Yeah.
That's not the case
anymore.
This
is not what this is about.
No, there's a partnership here.
Yeah.
And Libby would perhaps ask questions of Rhonda, or perhaps not necessarily even talk about the drawing, but use this as the basis from which to then determine where she's going. So over the next several weeks, perhaps the focus may be, how do we help Rhonda create a direction? Mm-hmm. How do we help her create a sense of place, create a sense of identity, a sense of solidity, and then perhaps revisit
Very
this
cool.
drawing mm-hmm. 4 to 8 weeks from now and say, okay,
hey,
what happened? What changed?
What was that? Yeah.
And we, I would bet, as good as Libby is, there would be a lot of changes that would occur several sessions later.
Interesting.
What often happens is that people place these meanings on the work because, you know, like a lot of adolescents mm-hmm. will do drawings that mm-hmm. may be bloody or may contain mm-hmm. skeletons or mm-hmm. may, if we can mm-hmm. harken back to our days back in the days when we used to listen
right.
to music, it might contain Metallica images and
right.
Black Sabbath. We worry about the types of drawings that our kids are doing because they may contain that type of content. First of all, that's developmentally appropriate. And on the other side of that is, wouldn't you much rather that came out on the paper?
Well, that's my question. You know, how do we do a disservice to ourselves as parents, let's say, and our kids when we shut them down?
Right.
And we tell them, oh, you shouldn't draw fat.
You shouldn't be doing that.
That's wrong.
No, it's... Yeah. First of all, that's exactly what they are doing in school. That's what they're doing around each other. And what you do is, instead of saying that's wrong, say, wow, look at the talent behind that. Right. Look at what you've created there. Let's take this and let's create other things. Let's take that figure and put it in a different environment.
Is it because we're just afraid of emotion most of the time?
Sure.
I mean, that's a very...
That's a simple way of saying it, but it's...
Short-cutted way of putting this.
But I think we're afraid of what we don't understand. The other thing we're afraid of is when our adolescents start to develop their own personalities that may be separate from ours.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden they're taking a different turn. And you want them to individualize. You want them to separate.
No, I don't.
You don't. But you and Carl have so much to work out. And you'll figure it out. Right, Carl?
Carl figured it out a long time ago.
He's in there drawing you behind with this what's this knife there doing in your dad's back?
Are you kidding me, man? He's got all kinds of instruments.
I'm a little frightened. That room scares me. There's absolutely nothing in there except Carl.
Yeah, right.
But I think, what happens is we're afraid because these might not be things that we see as average or normal or healthy. In reality, it's if it's a well-rendered, compositionally strong drawing, well, then that took a lot of focus and a lot of attention.
Right.
I'd much rather focus on how it was done and how wonderful it was that he was or she was able to express themselves in that manner rather than shutting them down and worrying about what that could emerge as.
Wow. Well, he's got another book coming out. This guy, you can't stop him. What's the name of the next
one? The next one is The Art and Art Therapy of the Imprisoned. And so I get to examine not only art therapy, but the natural art that emerges within the correctional arena. And that's the fun part.
How far away are you from publishing?
It's going to the publisher in December.
Okay.
And then it should come out in March or April.
Oh, good. So I won't have to talk to you again for another year.
For another year. And then following that, I have another project.
Oh, fine.
And that's the Frenzy Tango of Art and Violence. And that's with another publisher. If that's halfway through.
Now I'm so confused.
You and me both. Every now and then I'm like, wait, which chapter am I working on here?
Let's just do this.
Yeah.
When we get through the summer, maybe you can come back late in the summer.
That'll be a blast.
Before the fall semester and you're too busy to talk to me anymore. It's a great pleasure, my friend. And we do love you. And we appreciate all the work that you are doing, have done, and the contribution that you and your colleagues are making to our welfare. Folks, this is what we do here. We have fun with people like Dr. Gusak, who keep us thinking about more important things, the stuff that really matters most, in my opinion. And it's our pleasure to do so. You know, we're production of... before I say that, I should say thank you for being our guest.
It's my pleasure. This was a great deal of fun, as always.
It gets too informal sometimes.
That's right.
But we are the production of Alcom Media and Entertainment, coming to you from the studios of Moose Magnificat right here in Tallahassee. Carl Cerny is our executive producer. I'll be looking for you again next week. So come on, Tallahassee, come talk to me.